政治，民生起义。My Radio 2014。
特別節目未夠稱訪問，咁咧就今日咧係第一次本台 My Radio 咧有一個鬼佬喺度啊，阿 Ben 啊，咁啊呢個鬼佬係你介紹嚟噶嘛，係嘛 ？OK，
呢位就係 Matthew Tong。
Matthew Tong，
我哋幫佢改咗個中文名啊，杜浩倫啊。
杜浩倫，係 OK。So I just said that Matthew, you are the first 鬼佬 in this studio.
Thank you.
Yeah. So why don't you introduce yourself to our audience?
I am the director of a film called Mei Gao Ting, or Lessons in Descent,
yeah.
which is currently playing at the Metroplex Cinema in Kowloon Bay.
Yeah. Are you going to show a few more?
Yes, we will be showing it in the Metroplex at least until the end of June.
Yeah.
So you should be able to see it this summer.
Yeah. I just heard that it is going to be a hit, or it is already a hit.
Yeah, we're doing really well. You know, this weekend we've got another sold-out screening. We've had a few sold-out screenings already. You know, at Hong Kong IFF, which we had the premiere at, we had an amazing reception. The film sold out for all three IFF screenings.
Yeah.
We had a screening at Chinese U, and the demand was so great that they moved us to a much bigger auditorium. and then we sold out...You know, Metroplex, we were the first film ever to sell out for any of their screenings. So,
yeah.
Certainly people are making the effort to go over to Kowloon Bay and see this film.
Sure.
Really pleased.
Our audience will do that.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, we, you know, I don't think, you know, when we set out to make this film, I hope that people would watch it. But the response has just been superb.
And
so proud.
Are you surprised by the response to your film in Hong Kong?
Yeah, a little bit. You know, I was really hoping that people would come and see it, but I never knew. You never know when you set out on one of these endeavors. You just hope that people will come and see it. You don't know that people will come and see it. You just do your best and try to make something that people are going to enjoy,
yeah.
and it says something that people want to hear.
Yeah.
And, you know, the response has been overwhelming. It's been really good.
Yeah. But to tell you the truth, I for myself...I think this movie should have been done by us instead of...
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a valid point. And I think if you look at the credits of this film, you'll notice that 99% of the people who work in this film are Hong Kong people. However, you know, having a Guaylo do this,
yeah.
I think, you know, there's a slight level of detachment which I can bring to it.
Mm.
You know, there's this famous author called Bill Bryson. He's an American. He came to England and he wrote a book about the English.
I read that.
Yeah, it's actually a very good book. And it pointed out all the strange things the English do. And, you know, I wouldn't have noticed those things. But then when he pointed it out, because to him they were strange, I went, oh, yes, wow.
Mm.
And it's kind of the same. So I think I can bring just a slight detachment.
New angle.
Yeah, fresh perspective.
Yeah.
And I don't have, you know, any emotional baggage, and I'm not attached to any political party.
Yeah.
So I just see it as...you know, what is happening, and just try to document it as faithfully as possible.
Yeah, we just mentioned Hong Kong, but what about in London, the place where you come from, or in England? Do they care about Hong Kong, or do they care about your project?
No, I don't think. I don't think the UK has cared about Hong Kong since July 1st, 1997. You know, the interest... I think there are Hong Kongers who live in London who are interested, definitely. But I think the...
Like this guy.
Yeah, for instance, like Ping. But I think that the average Brit... You know, I had the... You know, just before I came out here, I had a haircut because I needed to look a bit smarter. And the lady, the hairdresser, she said to me, what are you doing? I said, I'm going to Hong Kong and have a film premiering there. She said, I've never been to Japan. I'd love to go. So that kind of tells you the sort of level of ignorance.
Was that true because in Hong Kong you was a former colony of...
17 years ago, people have a short memory. You know, and the empire and things is not taught at school. So, you know, nobody really understands about India and the empire and the good and the bad, well, mainly the bad, that was done. It's just completely missed out of our history textbooks. So, you know, many people are completely ignorant of it.
I thought Hong Kong is the only place where education system is... corrupted.
No, it's, you know, there's obviously I don't know what the education system is like in the UK now, but when I was doing it, you know, 20 odd years ago, you know, it had lots of good things, but at the same time there were some sort of things that you think, wow, how did that get missed out?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know how they make the decisions of what they think we should know, what they think we shouldn't.
Yeah. But how did you guys meet? Think, how did you meet
Oh, they may turn fine up.
No, you can do it in English.
Right. Okay. So we met at sort of a symposium at Oxford University. It was about Hong Kong, about Hong Kong's development of democracy. Quite a few graduate students, they were there to present their dissertation. So actually, we were there to challenge somebody's points about the church's role in Hong Kong's democracy.
So you guys were arguing
from the same side against a certain person. Yeah. And then suddenly I realized this guy standing next to me, okay, you know quite a lot about Hong Kong. What's that all about? And then so we took the conversation outside the auditorium and carried on chatting for hours and ignoring what was originally the program was arranged for. Yeah. And we became friends.
Yeah. I'm so amazed that Matthew is such a Hong Kong expert that I rarely met before.
Yeah, well, I just got interested in Hong Kong. It wasn't that I set out to become an expert on it. It was just that I arrived in Hong Kong in 2003. You know, I'd always loved Hong Kong movies, and you know, through my studies, I'd ended up in China before. Mm. And I came down to Hong Kong to live 2003, and it was just before July 1st, 2003. And I wasn't expecting that. It was kind of a big surprise. And then to try and understand what was happening, what was going on, why the city felt the way it did, because you know, you couldn't spend much time in Hong Kong in the second half of 2003 and not feel the sort of upset, you know, the city, the territory wide feeling of just being like, this is a terrible time. And you know, I wanted to understand that, and so I ended up just, you know, reading everything I could possibly lay my hands on about Hong Kong to try and understand everything about it. And you know, that's the obsession started, I guess. And it, you know, 10 years, more than 10 years later, it hasn't diminished. I'm still interested. I still love wandering the streets of Hong Kong and getting excited about this place.
I was told that you live here.
Yeah. When I made this film,
I mean Sham Shui Po.
Yeah. When I was making this film, I stayed mostly in Sham Shui Po because it's cheap. And
in those town hall.
Yeah.
And I mean the cubicle room.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, they are literally just big enough for a bed.
Yeah.
You know, that's it. There's no space. You know, suitcase is a big problem.
Yeah.
You know, at the end of the day, the film, we didn't have a lot of money. Well, I wanted to spend everything we had so you could see it on the screen rather than my own comforts. Mm. So I always bought the absolute cheapest plane tickets with lots of changes and, you know, stayed in the cheapest places and ate the cheapest food. But I think it hopefully brings a level of authenticity. I think if I had flown business class and stayed in the Mandarin Oriental
and lived in mid-levels, and
yeah, it just wouldn't have really... the film would have been a very different film. And it would have... I don't think it would have spoken to Hong Kong people.
Yeah.
So I always wanted to do something that spoke to Hong Kong people.
And you have been visiting Hong Kong for so many times. And what is your general feelings every time you come here? And any change or any?
Yeah. I mean, I think the thing with you know, being a foreigner and not living here permanently, but being interested in the place, you know, it's like when you see your grandparents when you're a kid. They always say, "Haven't you grown?" And your mum and dad don't notice because they see you every day. Mm. It's the same for me coming to Hong Kong. I'm not here every day, so I notice the changes more. Because when I step off the plane at Chek Lai Kok, the first thing I do is really take the temperature of the city. You know, what is the feeling at the moment? And I always, you know, that I think there's been great changes. You know, 2003, I think there was a feeling that this was a blip. You know, it was a economic crisis, there was SARS, Article 23, and I think there was this feeling that if we can just get rid of Tung Chee Hwa, things will be okay.
Yeah.
And, you know, and Long Hair, for instance, he wears his I toppled the tyrant t-shirt.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the end of the day, what did you get? What was he replaced by? Just another tyrant.
Yeah.
And so I think there was this feeling that it was a blip at the time and things could get better. I think now there's this feeling that it's not going to get better, it's only going to get worse. And that, you know, goes a long way to sort of create this sort of what I call the psychosis of the city.
Yeah, psychosis.
Yeah,
yeah,
I think
yeah.
the city is, you know, definitely, there's a sort of city-wide psychosis. You know, that's the sort of psychology of the city at the moment.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
How do you translate psychosis in Cantonese?
This is a challenge.心理的怎样讲好呢，我用另一个讲法讲啦，我们一路都接收很多媒介的访问啦，有想写影评的朋友就会发邮件给我们，我们预备一些访问，我们想问你以下问题关于电影的，但是呢，跟住嗰啲關於嘅電影嘅問題咧，其實全部都係關於香港嘅將來。即係我哋問下，咦？你都唔係問緊個電影，我哋變成占卜人士啊！我哋變成
係啦，
係啦。咁其實係迷惘加焦慮加不知所措。
I guess that these are the white words for the Cantonese translation. But Matthew, have you noticed that in recent year or in these few months, there's a growing sense of identity crisis?In the city.
Yeah, I mean, I think the identity, Hong Kong identity issue is one of the things that really, really interests me. It's probably why I've sustained my interest in Hong Kong over the last 10 years or so. You know, I'm a Londoner, but I'm also English, I'm also British and European. And none of those, maybe the European part, but the other bits, they all sit in...without any conflict. You can be a Londoner and English at the same time without that being a problem. Mm-hmm. I think what makes Hong Kong really interesting is when people say, I'm a Hong Konger, they often...
Is this a new word?
Supposedly.
So I don't think it is.
In the OED now.
Because we right now we find it in Oxford Dictionary.
Yeah, but they're always behind the curve. You know, it has to be in common use for quite a while before it makes its way into the Oxford English Dictionary.
Yeah.
But I think... you know, to be a Hong Konger, you know, when we normally say I'm a Hong Konger, we're not, you know, and you say, how do you describe that? Normally people list how Hong Kong is different from the mainland.
Yeah.
So, you know, to be a Hong Konger, to be Hong Kong Chinese, before 97, to be Hong Kong Chinese was to say, I'm from Hong Kong and I am ethnically Chinese. Now it is saying, I am from Hong Kong, I'm ethnically Chinese, and also,it's offering nationality, and it's a nationality where if you know the Beijing government wants to have a stranglehold on what it means to be Chinese, they like to define that nationality.
Yeah.
And yet the way they define it is very much at odds with what it means to be a Hong Konger. So for many people in Hong Kong, it's very difficult to be both a Hong Konger anda Chinese, that those two identities are somewhat in conflict. I mean, I personally completely reject the Beijing of, you know...
Definition
of identity and being Chinese. You know, I think you can be proud of your country without having to agree with the government. I certainly do. You know, I always reserve my harshest criticism for the British government, and yet I don't think that stops me from being British.
Yeah. Well, I guess it is quite unique in the whole world, because...You have this sense of identity in this city.
Yeah.
And I, referring to what you're talking about, I would like to keep it short.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a Hong Konger, just this.
Yeah.
Nothing else.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and I think, you know, that's the fact that people are saying, I'm a Hong Konger, rather than I'm Hong Kong Chinese, that is something that you're seeing over the last few years is really developing. And that, I think, is a reaction to people saying, well, actually, no, if I have to subscribe to the Beijing definition of what it means to be Chinese, then I don't want to be Chinese.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's what you're seeing with this new, I'm just a Hong Konger.
Yeah, yeah. But when you were interviewing people, and I mean, before, after this shooting, and how would people in Hong Kong react to the questions that we just mentioned? Were they confused, or do they have a very clear position on that?
I think the clarity of their position is ever evolving. It certainly was more confused a few years back, but certainly you've seen over the last few years this real identity starting to be forged. I mean, I think it was always there, but it was much looser and more fluid.
Yeah.
And you know, now you see the city is under threat. You know, threat does a very good job of solidifying identity.
Identity.
And I think that's what you're seeing now, is more people feel that they don't like what's coming across the border. Yeah. They don't like the influence. They don't like the changes. Then they hold on to their identity, their Hong Konger identity, much stronger, and want to resist.
Yeah. When you are saying threat, would you consider this threat as more political or economic or cultural?
Not necessarily economic. At the end of the day, you know, mainland China might supposedly run by the Communist Party, but essentially it's, you know, it's one of the most capitalist countries in the world. So it's, maybe the Chinese Fascist Party would be a better definition.
Yeah.
But, you know, culturally, politically, certainly, and somewhat economically. You know, at the end of the day, you know, how does Hong Kong's economy work? Well, it's generally been doing successful ever since the ICAC was formed and corruption was sort of
wiped out.
Yeah, I mean, well, never entirely, but certainly, you know, huge change. You know, Hong Kong's economy has been really one based on the rule of law. Essentially, the idea is that, you know, if you own property and your property is secure under the rule of law, then you know, that's what the whole capitalist economy is based on. Obviously, that's not the case in China. At the end of the day, the party is always above the law. So you can buy a condo in Shanghai, but if, for, you know, if for instance, some princeling wants that condo, do you think you're going to keep it?
No.
You know, then that's the thing. That's really the rub where it, you know, it all comes down to. But I think economically, these are the things that aren't all that interesting. I think more interestingly is culturally and politically. You know, the political system helps to form culture. So, you know, I think Hong Kong cultural identity is under threat. You know, you've already seen it in the language. Cantonese, the language, is being
versus
under
Mandarin,
threat.
Yeah.
You know, why is it that Mandarin speakers who come to Hong Kong seem to learn Cantonese?
Yeah.
But Cantonese speakers here are supposed to be able to speak Mandarin. I personally think that it would be much better if, you know, obviously Cantonese speakers here need to be trilingual if they can be. You know, I'm a fine one to talk, I know. But, you know, I understand the reason for learning Mandarin, and I don't think that's a bad thing. But at the same time, I sort of feel like, hey, if you're originally a mainlander and you come to Hong Kong to live, and you want to become a Hong Konger, you want to make this your home, then, you know, learn the lingo.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to me to be that. I mean, you know, I don't live here, so maybe that's why I haven't learned Cantonese.
You are an exception. But going back to that threat, the reason why I mentioned political is because we have this great debate.
Yeah.
Or even controversy about the future of this Hong Kong political system. So what is your general feeling or general view about this?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I think that the political reform bill that's coming is going to come this later this year. It's going to be a very big disappointment for many, many people. You know, we already know, really, you know, Beijing, their guys have already started saying this. They said this in Shanghai last week, that, you know, they reject civil nomination. They reject even public recommendation, which is kind of pointless anyway. So all they're willing to accept is that the nominating committee, you know, which is at the moment 1,199 elites, because it was the election committee, is now going to become a nominating committee, and that they're just going to nominate candidates that they feel are acceptable. But we already know that nominating committee is just a bunch of Beijing stooges, and Beijing completely controls it. So can a pandem get through? I don't know. I mean, you know, if you look at the 2012 chief executive election, a pandem got through. Was he a popular choice?
No.
So that seemed to me the pandem shooting themselves in the foot. What was the point of that? I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of talk at the moment about the threshold. What will the threshold be? I think that's designed so that pandem can't get through. So I think you'll find there's going to be a selection of pro-Beijing guys. You know, you have CY, you'll have Regina Yip because she's desperate to be chief executive. You know, I'm not sure who the other candidates will be, but there's you know, a selection of pro-Beijing stooges again, and is that really an election? It's not really. It's like Iran. You know, Iran has one man, one vote.
Yeah.
But the council of the Ayatollahs decide who the candidates are. It's exactly the same what's going to happen in Hong Kong. And to me, that's a completely pointless scenario.
Yeah.
And yes, it's one man, one vote, but it negates the point of democracy. And it's not going to solve the problem. And this is what I think Beijing seems to forget. That, you know, what does Beijing want? Beijing doesn't want to have protests in the city every Sunday. It really wants to have a July 1st go off without a big protest. You know, it knows it's never going to get rid of protests altogether. There are going to be a diehard group of people who are always going to be anti-Beijing. But it doesn't want to see the 500,000 ones. It doesn't want to see the 200,000 ones. It really just thinks, oh, you know, a couple thousand people, that's, we can tolerate that. It's no big deal. But so how's it going to do that? Well, it doesn't understand that the reason why people are protesting the streets is because they have no other way to have their voice heard. The whole point of a democratic process is that people's voices
get heard,
and that the government respond to them in a completely non political violent way. You know, so the only other way is violent revolution, essentially, to make sure the government does what you want. So it's in Beijing's interests to do something, but I don't think they're wise enough on that respect.
Yeah, I heard that you have been interviewing many people. A lot of politicians.
Yeah.
Have they been able to present them arguments for or against them, the things that you just mentioned, the political system or democracy? Have you got a very clear argument from them?
No, not really. I think you know, many of them have their views. I think really at the end of the day, the pan-democrats need to. You know, all people who are for democracy need to come together and need to decide, right, what are we going to go for? And personally, I don't think there's any point in having anything where the nominating committee is able to screen out a candidate. It's just, it's not democratic in the slightest. If you are not able to stand because the nominating committee says no, then that's no democracy.
Yeah.
So, you know, some form of civil nomination, quite exactly how it works, I think the technical details aren't necessarily so important, but the key thing is that people can stand for election.
Yeah.
That anybody can stand for election, and that, you know, you get to vote for them.
Yeah, not just pandemic.
I mean, you know, at the end of the day, the whole point of democracy is that everyone's involved, everyone's heard. You know, I have no problem with the tycoons or the pro-Beijing guys having their voices heard.
Yeah.
But my point is that their voice should be equal to the guy on the street in Sham Shui Po with a dollar in his pocket.
Yeah.
You know, they shouldn't have a louder voice. I mean, currently what you have is they're the only people with a voice, and you know, the million people who voted for a pandemic candidate in 2012, well, their voices aren't really heard. I mean, they fall on deaf ears, because the pandemic legislative members, you know, they might say things that their constituents want them to say, but at the end of the day, no one's listening in Legco.
Yeah. But imagine if you present this whole package to some countries in Europe, or say in England, how would people react to that?
You know, I think people in England, you know, they don't realise their own democracy is not working anyway. You know,
I'm surprised by what you just said.
Well, you know, look at the British system, right?
Yeah.
You know, we have a queen,
unelected
head of state. You know, basically a benefits cheat. She stays in the Buckingham Palace, living off benefits, you know, taxpayers' money. You know, I think at the end of the day, if you call yourself a democracy, then your head of state should be elected. That, to me, is a prime requisite, you know. And then, you know, we have a House of Lords, none of which are elected. They're old MPs who've done something, or someone's been pleased with them, and they've been put up. So, and then you've got House of Commons, where half the seats are safe seats. You know, for instance, my constituency that I live in, it's David Cameron's constituency, he has a 20,000 majority. It doesn't make a difference who I vote for, because David Cameron will always win in that constituency. So really, you have, of all the seats in the Houses of Parliament, what, a quarter of them actually have, you know, are sort of genuinely democratic. And you'll never weed out complete, you know, parts where, you know, certain demographics tend to gather together. But certainly my point that I'm trying to make is that democracy is a journey. It is not an end result. It's not necessarily...
It is a process.
Yeah, it's not necessarily just having one man, one vote elections that gives you democracy. Democracy is something that needs to be nurtured and looked after. And, you know, democracy is more than just a one man, one vote. It's more than just a free and fair election. It is also, you know, separation of judiciary, legislature and executive. And what you're seeing in Hong Kong is that they had that prior. Hong Kong had many of the institutions of a democracy without being a democracy at the time of the handover. And most of those institutions are now being eroded. You know, you're seeing more and more the... you know, the executive putting pressure on the judiciary to, you know, for instance, the kid in my film, Ma Jai, is a great guy, and he, you know...
This guy?
Yeah, he decided that, you know, he was prosecuted for desecrating the regional flag. Now, when in 2004, January 1st, 2004, I distinctly remember joining the protest and walking up to the government offices in Central, and there were people burning an effigy of Tung Chee Hwa. The police just stood by and looked on. You know, their attitude was, well, no one's getting hurt, they're making a political point, fine. And it was left at that. And, you know, free and fair protesting, that was. So why is it that 10 years later, when Ma Jai sets light to the regional flag in political protest, is he then handed down a sentence of 230 hours?
Yeah.
And then, you know, moreover, also to show you sort of how the judiciary is working now, they kept him in custody whilst they awaited sentencing. Now, I've never ever heard of anywhere in the world, in the free world anyway, where you are given a social, you know, he had to do social servicing for 230 hours, where you're given that sort of sentence, but you're kept in custody awaiting sentencing. They clearly did that to scare him, to, you know, try and make him not do it again.
Yeah.
To me, that's definitely political persecution.
Yeah,
I don't see it in any other way.
Yeah.
So I think you're seeing definitely more and more extreme judgments coming out by magistrates and judges. And I think that's definitely down to CY Leung's office putting pressure on them to do so.
Yeah. In short term, the news... is getting tighter and tighter.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you're seeing it with the media. Like, you know, we have to come on internet radios like this because there is no other way for free press to be working. The media doesn't report what's going on.
Yeah.
And they report it only in one way, which is always in a very negative route to anyone who's talking about democracy.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, I don't mind people attacking me for my views.
Yeah.
Provide an intellectual basis to attack me, that's absolutely fine. You don't have to hold the same views as me.
Yeah.
But, you know, the way that the media operates in Hong Kong quite a lot of the time, you know, I mean, the mainstream media, is they just omit it.
Yeah.
So we don't even have the debate.
Yeah.
We don't even have, there's no opportunity to attack someone like me because I'm silenced before I even get a chance to talk.
Yeah. And that is why we're here right now. Okay.
Yeah.
So, part one is excellent, and now right now we should take a break and then we come back.